them is reparcels. Bits and pieces of what I will be sketching have been put forward before by others, often by many others, but maybe the way of arguing is a little bit different in what I will be telling you. Now, you are all familiar with the notions of modality and evidentiality, but since there are quite different opinions on how to analyze them, let me nevertheless first briefly define and quickly go over the definition of the relevant categories as I see them. Modality is usually characterized in terms of a list of participating categories. There are very different divisions of it around. I think the traditional distinction between epistemic, deontic, and dynamic makes most sense, even if with some modifications. The slide here offers a brief definition of how I see the categories at stake. You'll find some examples on your handout. Apart from the addition of the category of Boulomaic attitude, one important deviation also for my story today concerns the concept of deontic modality. This category is usually defined in terms of permission and obligation, but in the present analysis, notions such as permission, obligation, interdiction, advice, request, etc., are considered to belong in a separate category called directivity, and that is actually the same category as involved in the imperative mood. And so it is an elocutionary category, unlike true deontic modality. True deontic modality is defined purely in terms of an estimation of the degree of moral acceptability of the state of affairs without it involving an element of obligation or permission. So in terms of the meanings of the modals in English, for example, an expression such as you can go now marks permission, and can is here directive. But when the speaker says we cannot tolerate this kind of behavior, she's not ordering or permitting anyone to do something. She's only expressing a moral judgment, and that is in this framework is deontic. Evidentiality in the standard definition, which I accept, is characterized as being about the identification of information sources. There's fairly little dispute over the evidential types to be distinguished, at least in terms of the rough division between direct and indirect, and within indirect between hearsay and inferential. You, of course, know all these categories. Many authors make finer grained distinctions within some or all of these categories, but these do not really matter for my present concerns. I should mention, though, that I'm not really sure, well, I'm actually quite sure that inferentiality, as used in the literature, is not always the same thing, doesn't always refer to the same category in languages. Actually, Eric Millac mentioned something along those lines also in his talk this morning. I have no time to go into this, but I should stress that when I use the term inferential today, I'm referring to the type of inferential expressions present in the West European languages, right? It's quite important to keep in mind. And then there is a few categories with an unclear status, which some authors have included in evidentiality, but which do not fit into the direct versus indirect division, and which are more plausibly considered separate dimensions, and discovers as the best known, most important one, the concept of mirativity, of course, coding that information provided in the utterance is new and surprising or unexpected in the default case for the speaker. Now, this is a complex category with many subtypes. I'm not sure the label as used in the literature always refers to the same thing. Again, I cannot go into that now, but I should stress again that a crucial component for the notion as I am using it, involves being in the mental state of surprise in the default case on the part of the speaker, right? That's a critical element for the concept of mirativity I'm referring too. Yet another category with an unclear status, in some ways similar to meritivity, is my own notion of subjectivity versus intersubjectivity, which marks whether what one is saying is one's strictly personal view versus whether it is rather rendering a common ground between the speaker and others, possibly including the hearer, a notion which I've also called evidential in an earlier life, but no longer actually. Since you're possibly not familiar, well, quite likely not familiar with this notion, let me say a few more words about it. This concept was originally introduced in the context of an analysis of epistemic modality, actually meant as an alternative for the traditional distinction between subjective and objective modality made among others by John Lyons. And it is meant to account for the difference between expressions such as for A and for B, right? With the impersonal pattern, it is likely in for A, the speaker indicates that her epistemic judgment is shared by more people, possibly including the hearer. While I think in for B signals that the speaker is expressing a personal epistemic assessment of the state of affairs. Now, and that is due to the first person singular form. So expressing this category in modal expressions requires a predicative modal expression. And so it's marked by the syntactic pattern in which this expression appears. An adverbial expression, for example, which does not control the subject of the clause, as in 4C, is neutral, right? It depends on being able to code the issuer of the assessment. But so it started with epistemic modality, but the range of the category extends far beyond expressions of epistemic modality. It, for example, also applies to deontic modality, to bulimic attitude, to inferentiality, actually, as I'll tell you later. And it can be expressed by means other than the grammatical one in 4A and 4B. Independent subjectivity markers are abundant. Examples are given in 4D and German 4E, for that matter. Now, I should stress that this notion of subjectivity does not refer to a general aspect of meaning categories, such as the modal ones, for example, or to a property inherent in them, in the sense that some categories would be more subjective than others. So it's not to be confused with the notion of subjectivity figuring in Elizabeth Traugott's analysis of semantic change in her concept of subjectification. It should also not be confused with the concept as figuring in the traditional distinction between subjective and objective modality, which is also usually considered to be a matter of different types of modality, to be inherent in the meaning of the modal category. So the present notion of subjectivity has an independent status as a semantic dimension. There are several elements pointing in that direction, including that it is relevant for and applies in the same way to several different semantic categories, epistemic, deontic, bulimic, inferential. Secondly, that not all expressions of these categories code the dimension, right? Which means it's not inherent in the meaning as such. And expressions can be neutral of these meanings, can be neutral in terms of this dimension. And thirdly, it has independent expressive devices, right, which are not tied to the modal markers as such. I actually wonder, after hearing several talks today, whether this concept is not in a way related to the notion of egophoricity. And to also to epistemic authenticity, as some people call it. I'm not happy with the term epistemic there, but anyway, I mean, you know what I mean. There seem to be some links there, but I can't go into that right now. Okay, so much for this overview of the semantic categories at stake in the debate. And the question is now, how do all these categories differ and relate? Now, before I try to answer the question, I should briefly address the matter of what kinds of criteria one can or should use for classifying meanings. In the literature on modality and evidentiality, or on qualificational dimensions, TAM dimensions more generally, a predominant criterion is the linguistic status of the expressions of the dimensions, and specifically the question to what extent they form coherent sets or paradigms of expressions, preferentially in the grammatical domain, and also to what extent these patterns are then typologically robust. Now, another criterion that is less manifest in the literature is the question of the semantic properties of the categories and to what extent they cohere or differ. Now, of course, these criteria are not mutually exclusive and everyone uses a little bit of both, no doubt. In an ideal or simple world, these criteria match in the sense that you end up with full correspondences between semantic similarity and linguistic expression, or forming systems in linguistic expression. But of course, language is not a simple world, in the sense that linguistic expression is determined by many different factors, of which the semantic or conceptual status of the categories is only one. And so trying to understand the relations between categories is a matter of finding a balance between the linguistic observations and the conceptual analysis. But of course, an analyst's profile may always lead to unwanted bias in one or the other direction. And so it's always better to be aware of the background of the researcher. And so let you tell me what my background is. In my own case, my approach is, of course, inspired by empirical analysis, mainly of the situation in the Germanic languages. I occasionally also look at typological data, but I'm first and foremost a semanticist. And so conceptual analysis takes a prominent place in my way of approaching these matters. And as a consequence, I tend to assume that if there is a discrepancy between the conceptual analysis and the linguistic observations, this might possibly be due to complications on the linguistic side, right? Of course, I can also be wrong in the conceptual analysis, but that's a different issue. So if I observe, for example, that the system of the modal auxiliaries in the Germanic languages allows the expression not only of epistemic, deontic, or dynamic modal meanings, but also, for example, of directive meanings or of hearsay evidentiality, I don't immediately jump to the conclusion that all these meanings form a coherent semantic set. Now, this example may sound a bit ridiculous, but it is only a slight over-exaggeration from a reasoning one sometimes does observe in the literature. Another important aspect of my strong concern with conceptual analysis and of the, as I call it, function to form approach to language resulting from this. So another important aspect of this is that I take a broad perspective on the range of expressive devices for qualificational dimensions or TAM categories. Right, there is a very distinct tendency in the literature to focus the analysis of semantic categories predominantly or sometimes even exclusively on grammatical expressions, such as affixes or auxiliaries. Now, of course, there is no denying that grammatical devices are linguistically special, and this fact should, of course, be part of one's theory, but that does not make adverbial or verbal expressions irrelevant. Right? They have their own special linguistic position. They are as valuable to help us understand the domain of the qualification of states of affairs, including the modal categories and the evidential categories. Okay, so that as an in-between, and now on to the status of the different modal, evidential, and related categories. If you take a closer look at these categories, you soon realize that there are a few semantic features characterizing them, either positively or negatively, and at least some of these features are arguably significant regarding the conceptual status of these categories. And if you compare the categories in these terms, some groupings emerge. And table one on the slide here offers you an overview. Let me first quickly define the features. So the first column, A1 related, concerns the question whether the meaning category relates to the first argument participant in the state of affairs or not. And there are two possibilities. The first subcolumn indicates whether the first argument is ascribed control over the realization of the state of affairs. And the second subcolumn indicates whether the first argument is addressed by an external source, typically the speaker, aiming to influence the first argument's execution of force or control over the state of affairs. The second main subcolumn of the second main column, S-oriented, indicates whether the meaning is speaker-related in the sense that the speaker can be considered to be present as a source. Everything a speaker says is in some way speaker-related, of course, by definition, but what is meant here is whether the meaning category at stake can be taken to explicitly code or be about the speaker's position relative to the state of affairs. And finally, the column scalar concerns the question whether the category involves a scale, specifically a scale marking the degree of intensity with which the category is present. And if it doesn't, the category doesn't, then it can have one value only, or it can be binary, or it can be multi-valued, yet without the different values constituting a gradual climb, an intensity scale. Now, as you can see in the table, neither the traditional field of modal meanings nor that of evidential meanings forms a coherent block in terms of these features. Instead, we get a number of subdivisions which cross-cuts the traditional fields. And so let's go through these blocks one by one. I'll actually be referring back to this table frequently. If you have my handout, you can always look back at it there. I will not be showing it time and again. So, directivity, first of all, as you can see, stands quite apart in terms of its properties, in line with what I said about this category in the overview of the definitions. It's the only category in the pack with a systematic relationship with the first argument. If you say you must resume work immediately or I'll fire you, obligation, a directive. you are ascribing control to the first argument. He's able to resume work immediately. In this case, that's the addressee. You're also instigating her to exercise that control. So there is an external source addressing the first argument. And that source is, of course, in the normal circumstances, the speaker. So there is speaker relatedness as well. But directivity is not scalar. Obligations and permissions are not degrees on a scale. They're fundamentally different categories, as has been shown repeatedly by several people in the literature, including Jean-Christophe Verstraeten in an article dating back to 2005. Dynamic modality stands quite apart too. Its properties are in fact very different from those of deontic and epistemic modality and are actually very similar to those of one type of aspect, namely frequency aspect or quantitative aspect as it's sometimes called. That's also why I've added this category, this aspect category in the table. So both categories have a variant that relates to the first argument, as in 6A and 7A. And they have a variant that pertains to the entire state of affairs, as in 6B and 7B. Neither of them is speaker related. They both simply describe facts in the world. If you say that he can come in, you simply describe an option available to the person you are referring at, to the first argument. And neither is scalar. Dynamic modality in particular is binary. It has two values, possibility and necessity, right? And that's it. Now, the deontic, polemic, and epistemic modality have the same properties, as you can see in the table, and these are quite different from those of dynamic modality, but also inferential evidentiality shares these properties, right? The deontic use of must in 8a, these strikes must end, they're ruining the company, and the inferential use in 8b, someone is knocking at the door, that must be John, share exactly the same properties. Neither is A1 related in any way, but they're both speaker related since they both code the extent to which the speaker can commit herself to the state of affairs. So they, as well as epistemic and bulimic, mark speaker reflections on the state of affairs. And correspondingly, they are scalar. They mark the degree to which the speaker is or is not committed to the state of affairs. So that's why I call these attitudinal categories. And the difference between the categories in this block concerns the type of commitment at stake and correspondingly, of course, the type of skill that is involved. Right? Deontic modality concerns the moral status of the state of affairs, and so it codes the degree of its desirability. Bulimic codes the degree of its likability, and epistemic and inferential both concern the existential status of the state of affairs. So, epistemic and inferential are closer together than either of them stand to deontic or bulimic, but that does not mean they are one category, I think. What they share is that they involve a reasoning process from bits and pieces of evidence leading to a conclusion regarding the potential of existence of a state of affairs. That's the process rendered in 9 on the slide. But they denote different aspects of this process, right? Epistemic codes the results of this reasoning process. And so its scale concerns the degree of likelihood of the state of affairs, but it denotes nothing at all in terms of the reasoning process leading to the assessment. Of course, epistemic assessments imply that you have evidence of some kind, or you're supposed to have background information in order to make a probability judgment. But an epistemic expression does not say anything at all in terms of what this evidence involves or whether it's good or bad evidence. It might be sheer intuition. An epistemic assessment is completely neutral in these terms. Inferential, on the other hand, refers to the quality of the reasoning process as such. And so its scale denotes the degree of reliability of the reasoning in view of the quality of the source information, right? It denotes the degree of confidence with which the speaker infers the hypothetical state of affairs from evidence. But it, strictly speaking, denotes nothing in terms of the likelihood of the state of affairs. Of course, due to the fact that inferential values code reliability, they hold very strong implications as to epistemic values, and these are even hard to undo, if that is possible at all. In most circumstances, it's probably not possible, right? If you say that something appears to be the case, it's hard not to understand this as implying that you consider that something quite likely. Still, this is, in my perception, an implication. And so the two categories do denote different aspects of the process in 9. Hearsay and experience are yet different and are actually very different from the situation in inferential evidentiality, as well as in the other attitudinal categories. When, for instance, you say, I hear he's going to Paris next week, there's of course no A1 relatedness. But there is no speaker relatedness either, in spite of the one singular form. These categories do not say anything about the speaker's position relative to the state of affairs, right? They, for instance, do not code the speaker's concern with the question whether she can commit herself to the state of affairs or not. And correspondingly, these categories do not involve a reasoning process of the kind involved in the attitudinal categories, as rendered in 9 on the previous slide, for example, right? Being concerned with the question to what extent you can commit yourself to a state of affairs, the attitudinal categories, in terms of some dimension, always means you have to check that state of affairs against the background of other information. And you have to draw a conclusion from this. And so the attitudinal categories require mental effort, deliberation, unconsciously, and sometimes even fairly consciously. But hearsay and experience do not involve such a deliberation process. They do not even qualify the state of affairs, actually. They simply involve registration and signaling of the fact that information has been obtained through a certain channel, be it the communicative utterances of other persons, or be it one's own sense organs. That's simply a matter of rendering a little bit or a little piece of meta knowledge and no more. And so also corresponding to this is the fact that, unlike the attitudinal categories, hearsay and experience are not scalar. Hearsay, as in 10, is monolithic. It's one-valued. You've heard something from others and that's it. And in the category of experienced, of course, languages may differentiate between different sense organs responsible for the experience, visual, acoustic, etc. But that is, of course, not a matter of degrees of experience, right? That's not a scale. Now, you might object, and many will object and have objected before, that hearsay often implies uncertainty too, in the sense that hearsay information is often considered less reliable than direct perception. Now, although the doubt or uncertainty may then be more about the source and only indirectly about the state of affairs. So even if there is doubt involved, this may not be entirely the same thing as epistemic doubt. But that aside, surely, in some cases, a speaker may use a hearsay marker in a context in which it is obvious that she has doubts. And so it makes perfect sense to say in German, er soll das Gemälde gestohlen haben, ich kann es aber kaum glauben. The critical point is that this element of uncertainty is not a necessary ingredient of a hearsay marker, and it can easily be cancelled, as in German 1b. Es soll da schön sein, da müssen wir bald mal hin. Where the speaker simply accepts that it is beautiful there, since he even wishes to go there. Right? You can easily find cases in which hearsay markers are entirely neutral as to elements of doubt. Even artificial examples like to see on your handout, I hear you got that job, congrats. Or 10, I hear is going to Paris next week, which seem to lack any element of doubt. And hearsay markers may even have a reassuring effect, for instance, when you are reporting on the opinion of experts, in which case they the marking even lends extra credibility to the statement. So in other words, epistemic connotations, if they may be called such, of hearsay markers, are contextual effects, and they are not part of the semantics of hearsay marking as such. And experience, of course, nearly automatically implies certainty, but even then, that's not what an experiential marker actually means. Semantically, it does not express certainty. It expresses a way of perceiving, right? And so for these reasons, I think neither hearsay nor experienced can be considered attitudinal categories. Mirativity and subjectivity finally appear to share the same characteristics mutually and are yet different and actually quite special. They have again no relation to the first argument participants, but first consider the matter of scalarity. At first sight, purely logically, you might think that both categories are scalar, right? In the case of subjectivity, the group of people sharing a view may be smaller or wider. And there may be different degrees of agreement on an issue. Similarly, for mirativity, you can no doubt be surprised to different extents. You can be a little bit surprised or extremely surprised. Still, I'm not aware of convincing demonstrations of the existence of graded expressions of mirativity. And I don't think I can imagine graded expressions of subjectivity. I've never seen any, at least. Correlated with this, also the issue of speaker orientation appears special. And there is a difference here with hearsay and experience, and a similarity with the attitudinal categories in the sense that the speaker does play a role. But the way in which she plays a role seems quite different from how she figures in the attitudinal categories. So unlike the attitudinal categories, neither mirativity nor subjectivity involve an assessment of the state of affairs, right? They do not concern the issue of whether the speaker can be committed to the state of affairs. When a speaker codes subjectivity or mirativity in an utterance, this does not affect the state of affairs expressed. Right? In 12a, for example, gee, there has been a bear around here. The observation that there has been a bear around is what it is, and it remains what it is. What these categories do address is the effect this state of affairs has on the position of the speaker. Right? Expressing surprise, for example, signals a clash between the state of affairs and what the speaker knows or assumes. So it signals that the speaker's knowledge and expectations are at odds with reality. Similarly, subjectivity marks how the speaker's mental world stands to that of others and whether they match or do not match. And so it's first and foremost about the status of the speaker's mental world and not about the state of affairs. So in the issue of the speaker's concern with the state of affairs, in the attitudinal categories, the focus is on the state of affairs, but in mirativity and subjectivity, the focus shifts away from the state of affairs to the speaker. And correspondingly, neither of these categories would seem to involve the types of reasoning processes and deliberations involved in the attitudinal categories, right? Being surprised is probably not much more than a matter of registering a clash between a state of affairs observed and what you know about the world. Being in the mental state of surprise would even seem to be incompatible with reasoning. It's something that comes to you all of a sudden. And determining whether you're expressing a personal view or a shared one, subjectivity, is just a matter of having knowledge about others' views and registering correspondences. So mirativity and subjectivity are categories of a quite special type. And so in sum, we're ending up with a quite complicated and confusing picture. And a useful analytical concept to bring some order in at least part of these observations is the notion of the hierarchical or layered organization or representation of qualificational categories. This is a concept that is used in several frameworks within functional and typological linguistics in very substantially different versions. There are a few references on the slides here. Actually, generative linguistics has a version of this too, the cartographic account of Cinque, but it's another story. Now, in the functional literature, the typological literature, this system is meant to account for the relative extension of semantic scope of the qualificational categories in languages and for the corresponding behavior of their expressive devices. And 13 is a strongly simplified version of the hierarchy, focusing on the categories at stake in my talk today. I have no time to go into the types of empirical facts leading to this hierarchy, but I hope the principle behind it is self-obvious, right? The different categories are ordered from low to high in terms of increasing scope. So higher in the hierarchy means wider scope, and categories have scope over those below them in the system, but not over those above them. Now, there are actually good reasons to assume that this hierarchy involves much more than just an account of semantic and linguistic scope, but that it constitutes a very basic dimension of our conceptual system, of the way we organize the world in thinking and memorizing. In fact, you can discern a very fundamental cognitive rationale behind the system. I have no time to go into details. It's quite complicated, but in strongly simplified and very abstract terms, climbing up this hierarchy involves a gradual widening of the perspective on the state of affairs, and correspondingly implies an increasing role for the person making the qualification, for the qualifier. And so the higher up in the hierarchy, the more the qualifier has to do in terms of drawing in information beyond the state of affairs under consideration, in assessing the state of affairs, and in terms of interpreting the situation of the state of affairs he or she is talking about. And so the higher up, the more room there is also for creative involvement on the part of the qualifier. This cognitive rationale actually also allows to link this hierarchy to the concept of subjectification as a process of semantic change as developed by Elizabeth Trogdon and colleagues, right? Subjectification is basically going up this hierarchy, but I don't have time to go into this now. Now, both in terms of their scopal behavior in languages and in terms of the cognitive rationale, the attitudinal categories are the highest level in the system, right? They form a block at the top of this system. But dynamic modality is much lower in the system. In fact, as you can see in 13, you can subdivide the categories in the hierarchy in terms of a few basic types, in terms of what they do with regards to the state of affairs. And the attitudinal categories at the top, of course, all concern speaker reflections on the state of affairs. In the middle are categories which situate the state of affairs in the world along different kinds of dimensions, frequency, temporal situation. There's actually also spatial situation there not indicated in the scheme. And at the bottom are categories that further specify the internal constitution of the state of affairs. There's only one category in the version of the hierarchy in 13, but there are actually more of them. And so dynamic modality, as a matter of describing the incidence of the state of affairs in reality, is part of the situating categories. The other categories we've looked at are not in the system for different reasons. Directivity is not because it is not a conceptual category, but a communicative one. It belongs in an entirely different part of our mental grammar, right? It's not conceptual. Hearsay and experienced are not in the hierarchy either. They are conceptual, to be sure, and they are not communicative dimensions. But as mentioned, unlike the categories in the hierarchy, they do not qualify the state of affairs talked about as such, and they don't fit the rationale of the system. And something similar applies for normativity and subjectivity. And so these categories must be somehow beyond the hierarchy. They somehow encircle it, as shown on this slide, right? Whereby mirativity, intersubjectivity, hearsay, and experienced each have a sphere around this core notion of the qualificational hierarchy. S stands for the speaker, and this is how you acquire information. Okay, I don't have time to go into this too deeply, but I mean, this is a very vague way you could see the relations between these dimensions. Now, no matter how you should model all these categories, and that is to a large extent an unresolved issue, right? How you should handle this in a grammar theory, what I've just sketched is extremely rudimentary, of course. But regardless of that issue, I hope I have offered some arguments for a substantial reshuffling of the evidential and the modal domains in terms of which categories belong together or not, and how they hang together or not. Neither of the two traditional domains is internally coherent in terms of the semantic characteristics of the categories considered part of them. And instead, the classification based on these characteristics results in a quite complex picture, which in part crosscuts the two traditional domains. And so I suspect that is also the case cognitively, right? That cognitively, evidentiality and modality are not coherent categories. Thank you. Just in time, I think.
Yeah, thank you very much. Perfect presentation, perfect timing. So we do have time for questions. Patrick Dandel.
Yeah, thank you, Jan, for this very stimulating, interesting overview. I have four remarks. First, you consider inferential evidentials as a scholar. And of course, this is true for markers like must and might, if you consider them evidentials. But is that the case for all markers? I was thinking when reading your article, I was thinking about markers like I infer, that's what I infer, that's what I conclude to. These are really neutral inferential markers. Or don't you consider them to be inferential markers? That's the first. The same for directives. You consider the directives as being not scalar. And that's, of course, true for mood, for imperatives, but and also for the example you give, you must go now. But is it true, and that's an order, but is it true for suggestions? For instance, you better go now. Je zou nu beter vertrekken. So in that case, you can maybe consider them as scalar also. The third one is concerning the quotative. You consider quotative as possibly having a high credibility. And that's, of course, true of very explicit reportives like volgens, selon, according to experts. That's the example you give. But is it true for the more normal and less quotative reportives like the conditional zou, blijkbaar, apparemment, disque, and all those where the speaker is not mentioned, because you refer to experts as evidence for saying that it can have high credibility? And then the last one is just to remark on your examples for dynamic modality. You put into the same basket two kinds of cases. He can come in if he wants to. It can rain heavily in winter. In the French tradition, they are very clearly separated. The one is sporadic. And I think there is a reason to separate them, because in the sporadic sense, professors can be boring. That can mean they are sometimes boring, or some professors are boring. That's the meaning of that sporadic modality, clearly described by Georges Kleber and others, I think also in the English tradition. And I think there is no alternative for the can. You cannot replace the can in that sense by a must. While you can do it in, he can come in if he wants, a need, ability, there can and must are both possible. But for the sporadic, I think it's not possible. These were the four questions. Thank you.
Okay, I'll try to remember all four of them. I quickly wrote something down. If I don't remember, you'll have to repeat your question. As for the I infer, et cetera, these are not evidentials for me. If you say I infer that you only use such kinds of forms when you're really describing a mental process in your mind. You will never express, he must be home. Why? Look, the lights are on. His car is parked in front of the door. I infer that he is home. You don't do that. If you do, then you're simply describing that you are making an inference. And that's a mental process. That's a description of a state of affairs, right? That's not an evidential. So otherwise, I agree that there are inferentials which are not scalar. Actually, there are some references on, or the references I've given on the handout, where I say that I'm not sure inferentials are always the same thing. Eric Milak this morning also mentioned this. There are no doubts, and I'm pretty sure by now that this is the case. There are languages in which inferentials don't code degrees, and in which they don't code a speaker assessment of the state of affairs either. They simply describe, like hearsay markers and like experiential markers, the source of your information, right? They would then be, that type of inferentials would, in my analysis, be classified along with hearsay and experientials, right? And this is, to me, a quite different thing as compared to the type of inferentials we have in the Germanic and Romance languages and in many other languages, right? But these are not the same things. And it's probably, it's clearly confusing that the same term is used for both, but that's another story.
And so when you have thus or so or something like the lights are on, so is at home, so is that an evidential? Can that be an evidential for you? Donc in French, there's a whole discussion about that. Is donc an like must?
That's,
donc il est, donc il est à la maison. And yeah. And that's not
but that's of course a connective, and so
okay.
What is the status of a connective? In any case, the category of inferentiality as it is expressed in many expressions in the Germanic Romance Slavic languages is scalar, right? I mean, and conceptually it's scalar, and if you would consider so an expression of that category, then yeah, you'll have to find a way around explaining why this is not scalar, this one expression form. But I'm not sure whether I would call that inferential. The second question was about directives. Well, all I can say is read the article, the very good article by Jean-Christophe Verstraeten referred at in my on my handout, which explains in a very, very convincing way that different types of directives, including obligation and permission, but also requesting, etc., differ in substantially different ways, which cannot be plotted on a scale, right? They vary along variables, like, for example, the role of the speaker versus of the addressee, right? The difference between permission and obligation is not, a permission is not a weak obligation, right? The role of the speaker, of the one who obliges or allows, is different in the two cases, and the same goes for the receiver. And that is true actually for the full set of directive categories. So have a look at the article by Jean-Christophe Verstraeten.
You'd better go is not a permission. That's a suggestion. That's a kind of order.
Of course. I mean, I'm not saying that there are no differences in terms of the strength or the face-threatening, the amount of face-threateningness of different directive categories. Of course, there is a difference, but that's not a matter of scaling in terms of the strength to which the category is present or not, right? That's why I'm stressing this concept of scaling in terms of the intensity to which a category is present, right? The third question was about quotatives, but I forgot what you asked.
According to experts, that's of course high credibility.
But Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, I didn't use the category of quotatives. Tanya Mortelmans makes this distinction, made this distinction in our talk this morning and made it before. I'm not entirely sure whether I go along with the differentiation, but you can use what I would not be not call quotatives, but real hearsay markers of the type I hear. In context, if the person from whom you've heard this is, let's say, I hear we're going to get a vaccination pass in the mid of this month, and I hear you hear it because it has been said on the radio, or you've heard the prime minister in an interview mentioning this. Of course, then this here receives additional salience, makes it stronger, right? I mean, so I do think that in clear hearsay markers, you do have this effect if the context is right. But it is a contextual effect. It's a purely contextual effect.
I would say the context allows to get a high credibility, but...
Sure. And then the matter of dynamic versus, well, first of all, there is, of course, there are different types of dynamic modality, right? You've got participant inherent dynamic, which is simply expressing an ability or a need for the first argument. You've got participant imposed dynamic, which means a situation permitting or necessitating the first argument to do something. And then thirdly, you've got situational, which is a category which is in the literature is often considered epistemic, but I don't think that's correct. It's not epistemic, which means the potential or the inevitability is simply inherent in the situation, in the state of affairs, and not linked to the first argument participant. Sporadic, to me, is an other aspectual category. Sporadic is frequency aspect. And of course, as I told in my talk, I think they're related, but this is something else. I mean, this is another category, right? They are related, dynamic and sporadic. Sporadic, habitual, that's in that set of notions, I think. And it's more about frequency.
Unless you put the example in the same basket as dynamic.
In terms of category, I'm not saying they're the same, right? I mean, I'm not saying they're the same. They're in the same category. I'm also not saying that deontic and epistemic and inferential are the same, right? I mean,
no. But if this example,
there are many other hands raised. Actually, maybe can we? Sorry, Simeonova was asking. Wanted to ask a question.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, yeah. Sure.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to your invitation to. Question further about the non-scalability of reportatives that you said, you know, it may be challenged and it will be challenged. So I just wanted to ask you if you can walk us through one more time through your idea why reportatives are not scalar and why that matters. And to just bring to your attention the poster from earlier today, actually, by Sumeira Tosun and Jyotsna Vaid. So they look at four different markers of reportatives in both Turkish and English. So four for English and four for Turkish. And what they find, it's an experimental study, okay? And what they find is that there is a scalable, there is a different measurement in reliability of the report. So I share the screen, which is her poster. To be honest, I'm only asking this question because she's not in the room now. And probably if she was, she would ask this question herself. So you can see that once we have more than one possible marker in the language, we actually see gradability. And I totally see your point with your examples from German, but maybe it's just that German doesn't have this rich inventory of markers that, and that's why it takes multiple meanings. But once we have different markers, we see differences in their reliability. So that's my question. What do you think?
Yeah, well, it's of course difficult if I haven't had a look at the data these authors have presented. All I can say is that I've never seen, and I've looked through quite some literature, I've never seen convincing examples of, but maybe this is a different story, and maybe I have to revise my view there. And of course, that would be important because scalarity is really, I consider that a critical feature in terms of analyzing the cognitive status of the category. But I've never seen any convincing examples of systematically coding of hearsay markers, systematically coding always the same degree of reliability of the state of affairs mentioned, right? And again, the question is whether it's reliability of the state of affairs versus reliability of the source. Mm-hmm. Which is, of course, not the same thing, right? If you mention or use any hearsay marker clearly implying doubt, in my perception, at least in the languages I know, this doubt is not directly focusing on the state of affairs. It's focusing on the issuer, on the person who told you so and so, right?
Yeah, but if I think
indirectly, then may affect the state of affairs. If you doubt your source, then by implication, you'll probably be doubting the state of affairs as well.
Yeah, exactly. If I think that the source is lying, then
think that the source is lying and still have no opinion about the state of affairs. That's a perfectly logical thing to have. I mean, it makes perfect sense. You can be completely ignorant about the state of affairs and simply question whether your source is valid, and then end up still not knowing what the situation about the state of affairs is. It would be a typical situation where you use an hearsay marker and then question its relevance. You may be discussing the question whether something is the case or not, whether we'll be vaccinated by the middle of this month or not. And so the prime minister told you, and you can say, I don't believe a word of what he says, because it's the prime minister and he always lies, or talks nonsense. And
well, then you also have to believe
question
that
whether you will be vaccinated or not. You're not taking a stance there. So you see, I mean, this is a really complicated issue, and I would have to look at this, the poster and at the data in order to make up my mind whether this really constitutes a problem for my analysis of hearsay markers or not. And
Okay, sorry, we only have time for one last question. Patrick, could you ask a concise question?
I'm going to try. So I had several questions. I'm going to ask one of them. I'd like to come back to the, it's a clarification question about your understanding of the notion of directives as you introduced it, which is slightly different from, let's say, Bultner's or Kondoravdi and Lowe's understanding of elocutionary directives. They make a distinction between those that actually semanticize elocutionary directives and those that are indirectly directives, and you sort of didn't mention that. But how about the examples you mentioned, like you must resume work, whereby that seems to be it could be challenged. Someone could say, "Oh, I disagree," which for Kondoravdi and Portner would be a sign that this is not a semanticized directive; it's only indirectly a directive.
It depends on how you use must and must as an order. I really wonder whether you can question it. Of course, you can say I won't. But you can reply that to an imperative as well.
Yeah, but you can't say I disagree to an imperative.
Well, you could say I disagree.
Or someone else.
If your mother says to you, you must come home immediately now. Can you disagree? I don't think so.
The question actually is,
you could say I don't.
Wouldn't be about the addressee himself or himself.
Agree
or himself.
With the fact that
someone else could actually disagree, not only the addressee. Well, it's an empirical question.
Yeah, I don't think I agree with the fact that you can disagree.
I think the prosody is making it different.
Expressed by a mode.
But the form itself lends itself. I think it lends itself to indirection, to indirect directives as well.
Yeah. Okay, we disagree there, I think. Okay.